Welcome to Wealthion. Wealthion founder Adam Taggart here, welcoming you back for another weekly market recap featuring our favorite financial market strategist, Lance Roberts. Hey, Lance, how you doing?
I'm doing good this week, actually. A lot better.
Good. Well, we'll dive into that in a second. I'm doing a lot better this week because clearly I'm not in my normal studio. I'm out here in beautiful, sunny, and hot Cartagena, Colombia. Just a wonderful trip. First vacation with family in way too long, but it's been great. And I promised them that I would get back to them, but I wanted to make sure that folks got their full dose of a weekly market recap. Folks, we're filming this a day early just because I'll be in transit tomorrow on Friday. So we got 4/5 of the week to talk about here. Right. But Lance, you're smiling, so I think it's a good week in general. So let's dive right in. I haven't watched the tape very much this week. So you tell me, what has the market done this week, and what is your theme for the week?
Well, my theme, since you're in Cartagena, Colombia, my theme this week is Romancing the Stone. So, of course, only old people will know that movie. So, you know, there you go.
I actually made my kids watch it before we came here, but hey.
See, that's great. This has actually been a really good week. We had talked about, last week and really the week before, we were expecting a rally. And we had said that most likely we would get a rally in the markets post the Fed meeting. And we actually started getting a rally even before the Fed meeting ended. We've been nibbling around the edges here. We bought some of our favorite kind of growth tech stock names right down near the lows, and we've had a very nice return on that over the last 5-6 days. So, again, it's just been a function of kind of trading this market right now. It doesn't mean there's risk off the table. We can talk a lot of today about what those risks are going forward and what we're concerned about. But this just goes to show you the problem with being overly bearish. And again, I'm getting a lot of emails from people talking about, how can you be invested in the markets with, the war in Russia and, the things that are going on. And, it's just, you can miss, really good trading opportunities to make some money. And again, we're not traders, right, at all. But what we do well, I say, is that, we reduce risk in portfolios when markets are very overvalued. We do that by selling off portions of our holdings, and then we add back to those holdings opportunistically when we have a chance, like we had recently with markets getting very depressed. You had very negative investor sentiment. You had positioning by, hedge funds, et cetera, that had gotten very, very lean. And those are good contrarian indicators for short-term market movements. Now, longer term, we can argue about economic dynamics, but markets don't always adhere to the long-term economic issues in the very short term. And again, despite the fact that this is the important thing here, is that people are no longer long-term investors, right? The average holding period back in the 1960s for stocks was 6 to 8 years. That holding period today is down to less than 4 months. So, sitting here talking about what markets are going to do in 5 years or 10 years is irrelevant when markets are trading all around you literally every 4 months.
All right. So, we're in that, we're seeing that rally that you thought may happen, right? So I think the key question at this point in time, and I was talking about this earlier with the guys at New Harbor, are we in a bear market rally, right? And it's not uncommon at all to see the market go down a fair amount like it did, 12%-ish or so, have a big rally that sucks people back in and then starts to head back down again. Right. So the big question obviously is, are we in a bear market rally, or has the market priced in and digested, what the Fed says it's going to do for the rest of the year and has come up with a rationale that's going to allow it to get back to the old time highs and continue, crunching even higher? I'm not going to necessarily ask you to answer that question.
I'm happy to, actually.
Well, feel free to answer it, but if you can, just share again with folks, what are the key indicators that you're going to be looking at closely to really, know what the answer is along the way?
So this is the very interesting thing, right? If we look at price dynamics, and technical analysis will tell us a lot of a story. We are in a bear market rally until it is proven not to be a bear market rally. Now, there's the answer for you, right? That doesn't seem to be very helpful, but here's how you know the difference. So right now, we're in a bear market rally, and that bear market rally from the recent lows could actually take you all the way back to the January highs. Now, that still doesn't mean that we're back into a bull market. We will need to break out to new highs and hold that breakout by, and there's some technical things we can talk about, but a retest of those highs that holds, as an example, would be a confirmation of that breakout. That would then confirm that the correctional period is over and you are still within a bullish market, right? Until that happens, everything that happens in between is a bear market rally, because we are technically in a structure where we have a topping process in play. The good news is that we did negate the head and shoulders pattern that was building. We had a head and shoulders pattern that was building earlier this year. We have temporarily negated that unless we break that neckline again. Now, we haven't done that just yet, but we did break above the 200-day moving average. We did break above the 50-day moving average. We've also broken the downtrend line. And this is as of Thursday. Friday is the end of the week. So what I'm saying right now could change a little bit on Fridays. But right now, we do have some very kind of bullish setup going on for the markets. And again, this is all very short term. And in 3 weeks or 4 weeks or the next 2 months from now, we could be back into a deeper correctional period, right? So just because the markets are behaving optimistically at the moment doesn't mean that any of the dynamics have changed. There's an important reason why markets are doing what they're doing right now. And that is because we just talked about this a second ago. So in January and February, you had a lot of liquidations by hedge funds, mutual funds, pension fund managers, retail investors. They were all liquidating a lot of stocks. And again, not necessarily the indexes, because the indexes were only down 10, 11, 12%. But underneath the surface, Adam, you and I have talked about this bear market underneath the surface. There's a lot of stocks that are down 30, 40, 50, 60, 70% over the course of the last several months. Meta, right? Facebook is down 50%. That's a huge, it's one of the big FANG leaders, right? Big part of the S&P index is down 50% in its price. So that type of liquidation event has left a lot of professional managers with a lot of cash on their books. Now, this is not that cash on the sidelines story, right? It's just they have cash in their allocation. You know, we talked about in our portfolios right now, we're carrying about a 30% cash weighting. So we have cash looking for opportunity. Well, these pension fund managers, mutual fund managers, et cetera, they have to report their holdings on a quarterly basis. The end of the quarter is next week. So they can't go into the end of the quarter holding 20 or 30% in cash. And because bond prices have gone down, because interest rates went up, they're now underweight in their bond portfolio. So if they're a traditional 60-40 allocation mutual fund, or a 60-40 allocation pension fund, they've got to put that money back to work. So when they report their holdings at the end of the quarter, they're not reporting a 30% cash weighting. They've got their 40% bond, 60% stock. So what we're seeing right now is the effect of two things that are happening simultaneously. One, we had a lot of negative sentiment. So all it took was a little bit of buying to cause shorts to have to cover. So the initial phase of this last week, and we saw these big up days in the market, 2.5% type days, that was a short squeeze. So those shorts were having to cover, and this was when we're going to the options expiration last Friday as well. That was part of that short squeeze. Now what we've got going on, and this could carry us into next week, is this mutual fund, pension fund rebalancing. Now, once we get past the first day of April, all bets are off. The Federal Reserve is talking about hiking rates 50 basis points, and we can start talking about some of the other dynamics as we go out further into the year. But for right now, the market is bullishly biased. We are overbought short term, and we're very close to triggering a short-term sell signal. So again, we may have a little bit more upside here near term. And I would use this as we've been saying, if you didn't like that decline in January, February, if you didn't like being down 10, 11, 12, 15% in your portfolio, use this rally to rebalance that risk, lower your equity exposure, raise some cash. And something we'll talk about, but we just bought bonds yesterday.
Okay, great. Yeah, I want to get in, obviously, in a little bit to trades that you've been making. Let's maybe pre-dive into that for a second here. The question I was going to ask, right until you mentioned bonds, was are you also adding shorts back in now here as prices are getting overbought in your mind? And the second was going to be, are you adding bonds? And I just want to note that the 10-year U.S. Treasury right now is trading at what, like 2.3%?
Yeah.
Something like that. So we've seen yields make a pretty darn big move over the past 2 weeks, right?
Right. Yeah. So there's two ways we hedge a portfolio. One is we hedge with bonds. The second thing is we hedge with cash. Sorry, there's three ways that we hedge, you know, and my math is not that good today. There's three ways that we hedge a portfolio. First is cash, right? So cash is always a risk-free hedge. So the first thing we do when we're not sure about allocation and positioning, we just raise some cash. Can never go wrong holding cash. You know, we talked about last week, Adam, that cash is not being impacted by inflation. If it's used for investing, actually it's become the purchasing power of cash has become better as asset prices have declined. The second way that we hedge portfolios because of their historical negative correlation is by buying longer dated bonds, treasury bonds in particular. Normally, when you have more market volatility pickup, money moves from risk into safety. So treasury bonds tend to act as a very good hedge. And you know, it's a safety, kind of a safety play for markets, and it provides an income. The third way we'll do it is to actually short what we call short against the box. And what shorting against the box means is that our box is our equity position, and then we add a short in to offset the risk of our long position. So we've got positions that we have owned for a long time, and they're positions that we'll continue to own for a long time. I was just talking to my co-portfolio manager just before we got on this line, and we were talking a little bit about positions that we own that we keep trimming them back because they get overweight in the portfolio. Albemarle is one of our positions that we like a lot. It's a miner in Australia that mines lithium. We carry a 4% position in the portfolio. It keeps growing to 5%. We trim it back to 4%, and we turn around and it's back to 5% again. So, you know, we have this kind of this position structure. And one thing we said we were going to talk about, I believe this week, if I'm not mistaken, you have to check your notes, Adam, is we'll talk about position sizing. I can't remember if that was this week or next week. We'll get to that.
Doesn't matter. Let's do it this week.
Okay. We'll talk about the importance of position sizing. But when we have these positions that we want to own long-term, we can mitigate that risk by adding a short position against those. So we're not ready just yet to add short positions because there is an upside bias over the next week, but we are looking to potentially add a short in the next, you know, maybe week or so.
Okay, great. And I understand the reasons why you're adding bonds to the portfolio right now. I'm assuming you're using TLT as the instrument there, but if not, correct me. I do just want to note one thing. I saw that John Rubino just came out with this article like 15 minutes before we hopped on together, the title of which is Global Bond Plunge Wipes Out $2.6 Trillion in 1 Year. Mm-hmm. And you've explained it enough on this video series before. I won't ask you to go into it in depth. I know that you're putting your money in long-term U.S. treasuries, long-dated U.S. treasuries, because you think that's sort of where, you know, money's going to flow in a crisis, right? And we talked about how that'll drive down the long end of the curve on treasuries. But the short end, you know, the Fed has a lot more control, that actually may continue to rise, right? So feel free to make whatever commentary you want around this. But the question I just want to hear you opine on for a moment is, interest rates are going up, right? That means that that bond yields will go up as well, and that means that bond prices will come down. And I'm talking generally. I'm not talking about the U.S. 30-year Treasury. I'm talking generally, right? So that's already that $2.6 trillion. You know, that's a lot of money, right? So what are the implications of the credit markets beginning, because we're just starting potentially, beginning to have losses of this magnitude? What do you think the ripple effects are going to be?
Well, two things are going to happen. First of all, you know, we look at bonds from a capital appreciation standpoint. So, you know, this is the interesting thing about bonds that I think is often overlooked by individuals. we look at the stock market all day long, right? And we go, the stock market's way overbought. The stock market's way oversold. You know, we're in a ripping bull market. We're in a terrible bear market. And at the bottom of bear markets, when you lose $2.6 trillion worth of stock value, what should you be doing, right? Buying stocks, right? But nobody wants to buy stocks because they've already lost all this money. So why should I buy stocks after I've already lost all this money? Well, bonds are exactly the same way. The only difference is the index you use to look at for your technical measures is the interest rate index versus the stock market. And interest rates get overbought and oversold just like stocks do. And currently right now, I've actually got an article coming out Monday on the website at realinvestmentadvice.com talking about specifically bond yields and what's happening here. But the name of the article is that we are about to be in the best bond buying opportunity in a decade. And we wrote this article now. We wrote it back in 2019, when just before interest rates went to 0.5%, because Jeff Gundlach said, oh, interest rates are going to have to go to 5 or 6%. And we said, no, no, no. And 6 months later, we were at 0.5% on 10-year treasuries. But we've been writing these articles every time. There is a long-term downtrend in interest rates where interest rates get to the point that it impacts economic growth and it creates a monetary tightening within the economy. Now, what is the Fed doing right now? The Fed is hiking rates on the short end to do what? Tighten monetary policy by raising interest rates and borrowing costs so that you will stop consuming. And when you stop consuming, that slows economic growth. It creates deflation in the economy by creating demand destruction. You start buying less oil, you buy less food, you buy less of whatever. It creates a demand destruction in the economy that creates a deflationary environment that slows economic growth, that brings inflation down. That's the whole reason the Fed is hiking rates. Well, guess what's happening right now? The long end of the curve, which is your housing mortgages, your car loans, all those type of things, is rising rapidly. We've had one of the sharpest increases in mortgage rates in over two decades, and that is going to very quickly impact people trying to buy houses. And houses are a big economic input because when I buy a house, I have to buy new furniture, I've got to buy a new lawnmower, I've got to buy whatever. So there's a lot of add-on economically for the housing market. Refi is over. Right? Who's going to refi if they've got a 2% mortgage? Who's going to refi at a 4% mortgage? So the mortgage companies are in a really bad spot right now because that refi business that have been driving huge profits for them, that's done. So there's a real probability that the monetary tightening that is occurring right now in the longer end of the curve is going to force the Fed into a very bad position of being in a recession a lot sooner than what expectations are. Right now, if you look at economic data, it's all great. And you know, I'm actually writing our newsletter right now. I'm just in the process of writing our newsletter for this weekend, going through the history of yield curve inversions. And everybody keeps telling you, 1999, everybody was saying, don't worry about the yield curve inversion. Look at the economic data. The economic data is super strong, and it was. And about 12 months later, you're in a recession. And in December of 2008, in December of 2007, economic data was very strong. Everybody said, hey, don't worry about the yield curve. The economy's strong, subprime is contained. A year later, then we talked about this last week, the National Bureau of Economic Research said the recession started December 7 when all the economic data was very strong, but the yield curve was telling you there was a problem. Today, in 2019, yield curve inversion, recession in 2020. Today, yield curve is not inverted yet, but we're getting very close to it. And very likely we'll be in a recession probably because of this combination of a more aggressive Fed, super high inflation, long end of the curve, interest rates going up. We're going to be in a recession within 6 months. And if that occurs, interest rates on the 10-year treasury are going to go to 0.5%, probably closer to zero this time, as money moves into a safety mode to get in and out of that deflationary environment.
Okay, great. And as let's say the 10-year dives like that, is that going to be, how much of that do you expect to be because of money flowing in for safety, like you just said, and how much of it could be due to a Fed pivot?
It'll be both. When the Fed pivots, they'll stop their quantitative tightening. They'll be buying bonds hand over fist, right? because they'll be doing QE. And at the same time, when they do QE, everybody's going to be moving into long-dated treasuries for safety to get out of the risk-off mode. Now, the risk-off mode, the initial drop in treasuries will be the shift from risk to safety. And then once the Fed starts their QE program, that will take about 3 to 4 months before the cycle catches back up and money moves back out of treasuries into equities. So if you go back and look at the history of QE programs, interest rates rise during QE, and we're not technically out of QE yet, right? We haven't started tapering the balance sheet yet. So we've only stopped buying bonds at this point, and we're just buying what's replacing is maturing, but we haven't started tapering the balance sheet. So when the Fed is doing QE, interest rates rise because money's shifting out of safety into risk. When that transition changes, money flows the other direction. And so, you know, back when, we saw back in 2018, as an example, when the Fed started getting into trouble, they're hiking rates, they're tapering the balance sheet. And, you know, all of a sudden they said, oh, we're nowhere near the neutral rate. Money just flowed in to safety because they said they're going to hike rates too much and cause a problem. Money went to safety. That's going to happen again here. And again, if we just take a look at interest rates where they're trading, they're three standard deviations below their long-term means. And we're talking the 52-week moving average. So the one-year moving average, there are three standard deviations below that. Every time you get that oversold on interest rates, it's been, you are at or near, we may not time it just perfectly, but we're pretty damn close to a good buying opportunity for treasuries for a capital appreciation trade. That's all we're looking for here. We're not holding it for income. Don't care about the income. We're looking for capital appreciation, which could be on the magnitude of a 20 to 30% increase.
Okay. Nice increase. Understand why you're playing for that. So let me just recap quickly. So looking through your crystal ball, as best you can tell right now with the data available to you, you think that, given all the current action that's going on, Fed quantitative tightening, everything else, that we are going to fall into recession at some point later this year, 6+ months-ish or so.
Yeah.
Deflation is going to start to win out, as you said earlier. And then capital is going to start flowing into at least the US Treasury market for safety. That's going to happen first. Then the Fed is going to say, oh, you know what? We tightened too much, too fast, and we got to reverse. And then they're going to start shifting from tightening back to quantitative easing. That's going to bring yields down even further. So that's all going to give you the pop that you're looking for.
Yep.
Sounds like you think then at some point, not too long after that, money's going to start flowing back out of bonds and into equities because it's, hey, growth's back on again. Mm-hmm. Can you just give, you're nodding as I'm saying this, so that's good. Can you just give sort of your best sort of timing assessment of that, right? So 6 months from now, we go into recession.
Let me stop you right there. Okay. Here's the big caveat, right? Timing is really risky. Just kind of making an educated guess by looking at the data and then trying to marry up where we are on, the Fed hiking rates. We're talking about a 50 basis point increase in May. Potentially, if they want to hike rates 7 to 8 times this year, they're going to have to hike rates by 50 bips at least, right, at two meetings, because they just don't have enough meetings to do a quarter point at a time, right, and get eight rate hikes in. Right.
And I think folks are currently chattering about back-to-back 50 point rate.
Correct. So my point about timing is this: there's so many variables that can change that can affect timing. If the Fed does 25 bips or they hold off a meeting for one reason or another, that can create a lag in the timing of the recession. There's also a lot of economic factors that are going to filter into that. So, basically looking at today's data, we can say, look, probably between 6 and 9 months, if everything remains status quo the way it is right now, we'll probably, that means inflation at 7-8% as well, right? That's going to create demand destruction. So that's a 6 to 9 month window. But if anything changes, that could be 9 to 12 months. It could be, 12 to 15, 14 months. But my best guess is that the normal average historical tendency from the time that the Fed starts hiking rates to getting into a recessionary problem is between 12 and 15 months. I suspect it'll be on the shorter side. So if we're going to place a bet that we're going to come back and share a six pack of beer over, I'll take the under of 12 months and say 6 to 9 months, we'll probably be talking or pretty close to a recession.
Okay, great. And look, you're going to get a chance every week to amend, you know, this as you see how the sand shifts.
Now in the media, I just get to change my view every couple of weeks. Well, I never said that, right?
No, and I'm not trying to pin you down on a particular day. That wasn't the purpose of that. It was to just get a sense for, is this an opportunity that you think you're going to be able to capitalize on this year? Or is it like, okay, if it does happen in 6 months, I then hold the bonds for another, I expect to hold them for another 6 months-ish, all things being equal, to then ride the effects of quantitative easing again, right? Or is it, you know, is it sort of a quicker hit you're looking for? Or are you playing a longer game here is really what I'm trying to
say. This is a little bit longer game. You know, again, because of not knowing the timing, we're looking at our bond position simply from a function that it's extremely oversold. It's in a bear market, technically. And so this is the opportunity that we want to own longer dated treasuries. Now, there could be a little bit more pain to the downside. And if that happens, we're going to buy more bonds. And we're into the position now because, you know, we had talked about before, we had bought bonds, had reduced our position on a rally. So, you know, we were underweight bonds in our portfolio. So now we're in a fortunate position that I'm going to buy bonds here and I'm going to overweight my bond portfolio if prices go lower. If prices start to work, I'll overweight my bond portfolio very quickly if my theory plays out sooner than expected. But this is something we're going to build into for the next 6 months and may not get a lot of bang out of it right up front, but I suspect that we're going to be in a position by the middle of this year or the end of this year that is going to start to outperform our equity portion of our portfolio.
Okay, great. Thanks. All right. I do want to get to position sizing. I want to make sure we honor that for this week. But before we do, because we're talking about the bond market, because we're talking about interest rates, personally, I've been becoming more concerned than I had been about the future of the real estate market. Mm-hmm. Powell's able to stick to his, you know, 6 to 7 more rate hikes in this year alone. Mathematically, as you know, that has to begin to weigh and pull down housing prices. And we have the potential, as you're saying, you know, going into recession here, we could have the potential of a pretty substantial market correction. Mm-hmm. We could, you know, where people's financial assets go down, that's coincides with a recession, right? Where people's earnings prospects get diminished, you know, maybe you get laid off, right? And their housing value comes down, right? It could be sort of a triple whammy for everybody. I'm curious, we're talking about some of the cross currents that could come into play here, but I'm just curious in general, what your outlook is for the real estate market in this current macro environment that we're beginning to get more clarity into here. It's for a lot of people, it's their biggest asset. Mm-hmm. Is it something that you're becoming more concerned about? And I'm curious too, just to tag on to that question, if we get this sort of switch from quantitative tightening to quantitative easing, do you think that could kind of rescue the housing market again, or are we in more of a secular shift here?
So, you know, that's a difficult question to answer very concisely, but here's my best push at it. First of all, there's a big myth about a housing shortage. And what I mean by that is a myth. They say, the problem is that we've got, you know, a housing shortage, which is pushing asset prices higher. And that's true from a standpoint that currently right now, there's a lot of people wanting to buy houses because the artificial inducement of cash into households gave people down payments. And again, we've got very lax methods for, you know, getting people approved for mortgages, et cetera. And we've got a lot of corporations now buying houses for rental properties. So there's a lot of artificial influences that shouldn't normally exist in the housing market that exists currently. But here's what I mean by the housing myth, a housing shortage myth. And this is something that goes around a lot. When the housing market turns, right? Right now, Adam has a house in California and there's a value for that house. And Adam, if I ask you right now, would you sell your house? Would you, or let me ask you a better question. Would your wife let you sell your house?
Well, right now, no, people aren't, right? Because they're seeing it as this wonderfully appreciating asset. Every year it's adding, you know, tons more to our net worth, right?
Absolutely.
And boomers as well. And you're probably going to talk about this, but like boomers, when they downsize now, they're not selling their old houses, mm-hmm. right? They're renting them out because of these great, you know, income investments that also appreciate year after year, right?
Right. Now, so having said that, and you're exactly right. You nailed it on the head. What happens when those prices start to fall? Because it's exactly the same thing that happens in the stock market.
That's why I'm raising this question, because I think right now, more people can imagine the stock market continuing to correct here than they mm-hmm. can imagine the real estate market going down by 20% right now.
Exactly. And when that happens, when the realization is that prices are falling, there is a rush of people to market to sell their house. I've got that. You're right. I downsized my house. I'm a baby boomer. I've downsized and I've got this other house over here that was $1 million property or whatever that I've been renting out. And all of a sudden it's worth 800,000. Oh, I'm sorry. It's worth 700,000. Oh, I'm sorry. It's 600,000. There is a rush to market to sell those houses. And all of a sudden your housing supply shoots through the roof. And when that occurs, prices are going to fall very sharply. So there's a real risk. And if you take a look at housing prices relative to long-term trends, we are back at the same level of deviation that we were in 2007, 2008. Now, there are some differences, right? We don't have the ninja loans. We don't have a lot of the other kind of financing mess that we were in back in 2007. But nonetheless, prices are extremely overvalued for houses, and that is going to cause a real estate correction. But look, let's go back to square one. This is a function of all the quantitative easing, all the monetary interventions. We created a bubble in everything, housing, asset prices, you name it. We've built a bubble in it. And ultimately, the majority of that bubble is in the top 20% of income earners. So if there's a liquidation event that occurs for any reason, it's going to devastate all these markets potentially at one time. And that's the real risk. And it may be something that the Fed can't bail out the next time, because in order for the Fed to do QE, they've got to have treasury issuance. There may not be an appetite for the treasury to go another $5 trillion in debt the next time around. Let's just assume we've got, you know, a Republican controlled House and Senate, and we've got a Republican president next time around, and there's a more conservative bent to the outlooks and saying, hey, you know what, we're trying to you know, reduce our deficit and our debt. You know, we can't, you know, we're not going to do checks to households. All of a sudden the Fed, I'm not saying that's going to happen, because the first thing that's going to happen from now on is that every time there's a problem, they're going to send checks to households. That's going to be the first go-to. But my premise is that if there's ever an issue where there's not enough treasury issuance for the Fed to do QE, because the treasury market has to issue the bonds for the Fed to buy to do QE, there's going to be a potential that this market could go down a lot further than people expect before the bailouts start to work.
Okay, great. And I know that I could probably get to talk about this in a lot more detail for a lot longer. And I actually am earmarking to do that on another one of these in the future, because I think that is a very underappreciated risk right now to at least the average house owner. And I think that for most people, right, it's their largest asset or one of their biggest assets, but it's a leveraged asset. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the destruction, you know, when prices come down, when you have a leveraged investment, can be a lot more than I think that folks, let's say, are prepared for right now. Yeah. With that being said, though, I want to leave enough time to do justice to our position sizing topic. So, Lance, right. if you can squeeze that in here in the last segment, let's do it.
Sure. One of the things that, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, here you and I, and talk about managing a portfolio is like, you know, hey, we bought this and, you know, we're trimming off profits here and we're doing this. And one of the things, the emails that I always get is like, well, I don't understand why you sold all of, you know, Apple. It's like, we didn't sell all of Apple. We just reduced it. And this is a hard concept for a lot of people to understand, is they think that when you have to buy or sell something, that you have to buy or sell all of it, and you can't just sell some of it, right? Apple breaks, I'm not picking on Apple, by the way, I'm just using it as an example. But let's say that you own Apple and it breaks the 200-day moving average, right? The first knee-jerk reaction of people is to, oh, it broke the 200-day moving average. I'm supposed to sell it. So they sell the whole thing. And now the problem is that Apple turns right around and it goes back up. And now they go, well, I can't buy it back. I just sold it. And then they're kicking themselves because now it's going up and they've sold out of it at the wrong time and they hate themselves. And then they start making other mistakes with their portfolio. And so the thing that we talk about a lot is about risk management, right? But we don't ever really describe what risk management is. And risk management comes in a whole lot of forms. Risk management comes into raising cash and holding cash levels that can lower the volatility of a portfolio, adding in alternative assets that are non-correlated to markets, i.e. bonds versus stocks. Understanding where risk falls in terms of the amount of positioning I'm taking in certain areas. So for instance, I've moved my portfolio, and we talked about last week about making one-way bets, right? So I've now moved my entire portfolio into energy stocks because energy prices are going up. That's a great move for right now, but when that move ends, it's going to be very painful and you're going to lose a lot of money very quickly. And we kind of experienced that a couple of Mondays ago. We had talked about this on the show about taking some reducing risk in energy stocks. And then like on Monday and Tuesday, energy prices were down like 40%, right? So, I mean, you know, that's how those things can occur. So risk, and I tell you what, let's just use energy as an example here, because I think it's good because a lot of people are buying energy stocks right now. So if I buy a position in a portfolio, the first thing I do, and now this is specific to risk sizing, right? And if you ever read the book by Steve Kobel on the way of the turtle in terms of turtle trading, et cetera, there's all good traders have a very basic premise, which is they never put so much money into a position that if that position goes to zero, it destroys the entire capital structure of their portfolio. So, you know, we talk a lot about playing poker, and this is the problem with buy and hold investing, right? So, you know, if you want to be a buy and hold investor, that's completely up to you, but think about it this way. If you went to Vegas and played poker, every hand with buy and hold investing, you're investing your entire net worth, every hand, you're all in. So as long as you're winning hands, it's great. But the one time that you lose, you're out of the game. And that's the bear market when it comes along. And of course, this is where people tell you, oh, don't worry about that because eventually you'll get your money back. Yeah, you will, but you've lost 5 years of your life getting back to even. You're now 5 years closer to retirement. And if it happened when you were at retirement, now you've kind of really screwed up your whole retirement. So being all in every hand is not a good way to manage risk in your portfolio. So when you think about, and again, using energy stocks as a good example, if I have a position in ExxonMobil as an example, and oil prices are going up and it's working well for me, how much can I lose in ExxonMobil before it destroys the entire portfolio and it completely wipes out my potential to grow my portfolio over time for retirement? So if that's 5%, 10%, 15%, 20%, you pick it. But once you get the concentrated positions, it all sounds great and fun and fine as long as asset prices are rising. But when they go the other direction, this impairs you very quickly. So for us, and I'll just tell you how we do it, and you can pick your own parameters of how you want to do it. For us, a maximum weighting. So when we talk about risk sizing, I say, okay, how much can I invest of a client's money, right? This is not my money. This is my client's money. So when something goes horribly wrong, it doesn't hurt me. It destroys my client. So that's the one thing I never want to have happen. I've been managing money for 35 years. I've never had to have a conversation with a client that says, I'm sorry I lost half your money, but this is how we're going to get back. That's never happened and it's never going to happen because of the way that we manage money. So if I buy a position in ExxonMobil, its maximum weight can be 5%. It can never be more than 5% of the portfolio. Otherwise, I have to trim it back to 5%. Why 5%? Well, if 5% of the portfolio goes to zero, 95% of my portfolio is still intact. So I have not, I've certainly impaired the return of the portfolio by losing 5% of the money, but it doesn't cripple me to the point that I can't make it up somewhere else. But when I'm uncertain in markets, we don't buy 5% of a portfolio every single time. Most of the positions in our portfolio are somewhere between 2 and 3% because of where we are right now in terms of market uncertainty. If I was more confident in the markets and we were, you know, had the Fed doing $180 billion a month in QE, which is what it'll be next time, you know, interest rates are back to zero, then all of a sudden, yeah, I'm going to have 20 positions in my portfolio. They're all going to be trading at 5%. And, you know, we're going to go on down the road because I've got a lot of confidence at that point that markets are going to go higher. But when that risk outweighs that potential reward, I want to reduce those position sizes. So we were just talking about earlier about Albemarle is a good example. We've bought and sold Albemarle numerous times over the course of the last couple of years because of what's been happening with lithium companies and this whole green energy thing. And I was joking that every time that we reduce the position, it runs back up to 5%. So that's part of that structure. Right now, Albemarle is a 4% weight in our portfolio, not 5%. So we trim it back to 4%. AbbVie is another good example of that. It's a 4% weight in our portfolio. It was 5%. We trimmed it back today as a good example, back to 4% because it had gotten overweight relative to where we felt comfortable with the portfolio exposure in that company. That company, you know, AbbVie was trading at into 3 standard deviations above the 50-day moving average, very overbought. It's had a terrific run here. We took a little bit of money off the table. We put that into cash, and we'll look to do something with that later. Maybe buy AbbVie back. If it pulls back, we'll put that money back. So again, that's the other way this works also. If I have a position, say Albemarle, and it goes to 5%, and I trim it back to 4%, and then the stock falls to 3%, the cash that I raised from selling it from 5 to 4, I'll then take that cash and buy it at 3%, bring it back up to 4%, which allows me to then grow that capital again. So, you know, we talked recently, and I've got an article coming out on this for you, Adam, about gardening, right? And why portfolio management is like gardening. And risk management and position sizing is just like a garden. If I plant carrots, as a good example, I plant the carrots grow, I water it, I feed it, I do a great job, I do everything I'm supposed to do, but I never harvest the carrots. The carrots will just literally rot in the ground and I'll lose the entire harvest. So if I don't regularly kind of harvest my bounty and then replant that bounty at certain times or replant that garden, the garden won't grow effectively. So by managing the risk controls and by managing my position sizing, if we do get into a position to where markets are down 10 or 15 or 20%, my portfolios won't go down nearly as much because I've already reduced a lot of that position size. When the markets were down 12% earlier this year, we were down about 4% on our equity-based portfolio. So, you know, that's the structure of why managing the risk is more important. And most importantly, it allows for two things. One, it lets our clients sleep better at night. You know, they're not panicking. They're looking at the market. They're panicking over the market. And then when we talk to them about their portfolio, it's like, yeah, but your portfolio is only doing this. And then they're like, oh, okay, I get that. Okay, that I understand now. You know, but there's this disconnect. But managing that risk can help you stay in your positions long-term, which is the goal. We want to be long-term investors. I want to buy companies that have very long track records for growth. And I'm looking out, you know, 20 years from now, where's Microsoft going to be? Where's Google going to be 20 years from now? Where's Snowflake going to be? Whatever, right? Pick your company. Where's that going to be 20 years from now? Well, I don't have to suffer all the ups and downs of that. I can grow that position over time and still hold it long-term as long as I'm managing my risk short-term. And if something, heaven forbid, in my portfolio goes down 70%, like some of the ARK stocks did, it doesn't kill my whole portfolio because I don't have my whole portfolio invested in those type of companies alone. See, I would never run an ARK type fund. I appreciate what Cathie Woods does, but I don't have that kind of balls to run that kind of risk and manage that kind of drag on client money. We don't have the capability of doing that. I can have some of those positions, and I have those positions in my portfolio that have high beta, NVIDIA, AMD. Those have high beta stocks, but they're a small position in the portfolio. And heaven forbid, if something goes to zero, it's not going to wipe out my entire structure.
All right, great. That was a great explanation. And you actually answered several of the questions that I had along the way. Biggest one being, you know, what do you do with the capital after you trim it back? Mm-hmm. And it sounds like I heard you say, usually we put that to cash and then we look at the rest of the portfolio over time and say, hey, are there more things that we want to buy at this time? And you now have the capital to do that with.
And that's let me stop you right there real quick. Yeah, let me stop you right there real quick, because that's a great point. Because one of the things that people do is when they sell something, they think they immediately have, here's some of the basic mistakes that people make. I sold something, I've got to push that cash to work right now. I sold it, I have to buy something else. Here's the other great one that I don't understand, but you know, and maybe somebody can help me understand this, but let's say they sell ExxonMobil or they sell Apple, right? And the stock is coming down, it breaks support, they sell the whole thing. And they're like, okay, you know, I honored my stop loss. Good job. And then the stock turns around, it goes back up, and they never buy it back because they feel like they're in some type of club now. They're excluded from ever owning Apple again. You know, those are psychological things. Where, you know, just because I get stopped out of something doesn't mean I can't turn right around and buy it back. Now, if you want to worry about, you know, short-term gains and losses, you have to wait 30 days, but there's nothing that says you can't buy back something you sold, you know, at some point in time. And, you know, those are kind of just the emotional trials and tribulations people go to. But the best thing to do whenever you sell something is take that cash, put it away, step back, reevaluate your portfolio, look at all your positions. Where am I strong? Where am I weak? Where do I need to reposition that cash? And if I don't have a good answer, be Warren Buffett. Sit on cash. There's nothing wrong with it until you find the right opportunity to put that cash to work, because that's all investing is. It's just finding the right opportunity. There's nothing that says we have to buy something every day. I can wait months to find the right opportunity to buy something.
Well, that's great. And you're hammering home the point that I made last week, which is one of the main reasons why you want to work with a financial advisor and want them to be in cash, at least in a good chunk of the portfolios, because you're paying for their expertise of when to know to be in cash and when to know to not be in cash, right? And you're overseeing that kind of in and out breathing of the portfolio, right?
Right.
And Lance, you just mentioned like several, you know, common pitfalls and whatnot, as well as just the general, like, okay, you know, you obviously, this needs to work well in a diversified portfolio, right? I mean, you can't have a bunch in ExxonMobil and a bunch in another, you're 5% in ExxonMobil, then 5% in another oil producer, and then 5% in another oil producer, because then you're not diversified at all. And they could all go to zero at the same time. That's
exactly
involved, right?
Right.
So you're making the case about, all right, I got to structure a well-diversified portfolio. I got to figure out which industries I want exposure to, given, you know, what's mm-hmm. happening in the world right now. I want to determine what my right percentage is. Is it 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, whatnot? And then I want to be able to monitor it, you know, fairly closely over time to see, okay, if it's getting oversized, I want to trim it back. And then you got to pull the trigger, get the cash out. And then you need to then say, okay, when and where does that cash get redeployed? I think those are all great. You've given sort of independent do-it-yourself investors some really good tips here. I would say for the majority of people, I think you're really underscoring what they should be looking for in a financial professional to do for them. So thank you for doing that.
Sure.
All right. Anything else on position sizing before we wrap this thing up? And I've got one new topic I want to introduce with you, given the fact that I'm here in Columbia.
Gotcha. No, I think we're good there. But again, this is something we're probably going to touch on, you know, from time to time. We'll do some shows about, you know, risk trading and, you know, how to manage your portfolio better. We'll do some more do-it-yourself type, you know, conversations for individuals that want to manage their own money.
Great. And guys, if there's any specific topics around that you want to see, just let us know in the comments section, and I'll use that to help structure the topic programming of future videos we do here. All right. So last point, Lance, is so I'm here in Cartagena, Colombia, and it's providing a really interesting reminder of the importance of hard currencies, of currencies that you can have confidence in. So Cartagena itself basically grew around the silver trade, the precious metals, but mostly silver, that the Spanish conquerors took out of South America. And look, they did a lot of horrible things to this continent. But a huge focus for that was, it was the supply of basically the wealth that made Spain the tremendous empire that it became. Cartagena is located right at the tip of South America. So the massive gold mines, especially in Peru, there's a basically a mountain of silver there called Potosi, which supplied Spain with the vast majority of its silver. And so these mule trains would bring all the ore up to Cartagena, and then it would get on those big treasure galleons and be sent back to Spain. So this whole city is shaped by that experience, right? And you know, gold and silver were a monetary standard, you know, for centuries and centuries and centuries. And this was a big part of that at that point in time. I was also earlier today at the Gold Museum here, which went back into kind of gold's role in the pre-Columbian tribes that lived here in South America. And you can see it went back, you know, for thousands of years, right? It's a very consistent way in which wealth was held and transported and funded economies, et cetera. So I contrast that with walking the streets here. You know, there's a lot of sort of, you know, beggars on the street that will come up to you. And I've been here a few years ago because I've got a family that lives down here. And I'm seeing more of those street beggars now. And a number of them are from Venezuela, right? And these are people that fled basically the hyperinflation that was going on in Venezuela to come here just to basically be able to provide some sort of future where their family could eat, right? And so you can see families on the street here that are begging. And you know, the problem is they've come to a quote unquote better economy, but it's still, there's a, you know, the poor classes are fairly large here still. So there's not real jobs for these Venezuelan immigrants to come in and get. And so they really are, they don't have any other options but to literally beg on the street for food. And to me, it just really hits home, you know, what happens when a nation destroys its fiat currency, right? And, you know, a lot of what we're talking about right now is rooted in monetary policy, right? You were just going on a rant earlier about how the Fed's, you know, policies not only have created issues, you know, with inflation, but in the markets, but also in the real estate market. And that's why we call it the everything bubble, right? So I feel like I'm seeing a real, you know, direct evidence of, you know, the evils that happen from you know, poorly managing your national currency here. I'm also interestingly seeing, proof of Brent Johnson's dollar milkshake theory, where, you know, my family that's lived down here, they have seen the purchasing power of the Colombian peso basically get cut in half since they've lived down here. So you are seeing, you know, basically capital beginning to move more into the US dollar as, you know, parts of the rest of the world get a little bit shakier. But writ large, you know, we've got lots of people from lots of different countries watching this video, and we've got a lot of Americans who are thinking, that really couldn't happen here, but it can, right? So I know I'm kind of going on a long rant here, but it's really just been hitting me home as I walk around here that, you know, the things that we talk about, you know, they aren't just academic. I'm actually seeing the repercussions play out in real time down here. So I know you're more of a market focused guy. You do macro. We don't talk an awful lot about currencies. Right. But I'm just curious to kind of get your thoughts on this, because, you know, at the end of the day, all the currencies that the assets that we generally talk about, stocks, bonds, et cetera, they're denominated in some type of fiat currency.
Right.
You know, yes, some may appreciate versus others at any one given time, but I think we can make a pretty good argument, especially given commodities, you know, all the fiat currencies are going down versus those hard assets. So, right. Any parting words you have on kind of the importance of managing?
That's a very long, that's a whole show that we can do together on currencies. But, you know, the one thing to remember, and look, I've been getting this question a whole lot lately from people. It's like, well, the dollar is going to zero like next week. That's not going to happen. And in fact, don't be surprised if the dollar doesn't get stronger over the course of the next, you know, few months, next year or so, next 2 years. because again, right now, the whole world, as you correctly state, Adam, is a fiat currency. There is nobody on a hard currency. And so this is really just a challenge of which currency do you want to be in more than others? And if I've got reserve currency sitting anywhere in the world, do I want to be in the US dollar or do I want to be in the Russian ruble or do I want to be in the Chinese yuan? And we can all make arguments about all these, right? But, you know, there's a risk to the Chinese yuan. I was talking to a guy just the other day and he's like, well, you know, China's going to, you know, completely dominate the whole world. And so probably having money in the Chinese yuan makes a whole lot of sense. I like, yeah, that's great. Until the Chinese government says, yeah, we don't really like America. We'll just take all your money. And that's it. And if you don't think that'll happen, it happened in Malaysia. So, you know, these things happen. Governments that are ruled by dictators, they just go, well, you know what? We'll just take all your money. The one thing that the United States has, at least for the moment, and we're doing a really good job of screwing this one up, is the rule of law, which has really been the backbone underpinning the value of the dollar, because people are saying, look, I've got recourse. If there's something that goes on, I have a contract that fails, whatever it is, I've got recourse through the courts to go get this thing resolved. Contract law is very important to the underlying strength of an economy. Again, we're doing some really good job of destroying that. We started that in 2008 by not holding people value to their mortgages. So, you know, we are deteriorating the value of the dollar, but again, at this point, we're still a fiat currency relative to everybody else. So again, you know, 20 years, 30 years from now, I'm not arguing with you at all, Adam. You know, I don't know what we're going to be like in 20 or 30 years. We'll figure that out when we get there. But from a management, from a money management standpoint, we need to be aware of that risk, but we also need to focus on what we can control in the here and now, because we talked about this early on in one of our sessions. If we adopt a really bearish attitude, we're going to miss out on the opportunity of making money when we need to make that money to make sure our purchasing power parity longer term remains intact. And missing out on opportunity is just as bad as being in a bear market. You know, again, if I missed out on the 400% advance since 2009, and there's a lot of people that did because they were worried about all these things, that's worse than missing the 50% decline in the market. So, you know, these are all very important points, and I'm not dismissing them at all. You and I agree on a lot of this stuff, but as a portfolio manager, I've got to separate these things out into buckets and say, that's something that's a long-term risk. I will keep a watch on that, and we will hedge that risk as it becomes more visible to us. But right now, the dollar's holding in fine. The dollar's actually has been very strong over the last couple of years. And so that's a risk that I'm focusing on by being more domestically allocated than internationally allocated because of what's happening with the dollar.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I totally agree with you, and I'm glad you're clarifying that for folks, because I the point I was making was really more of like a, yeah, let's lean back with drinks in hand to talk about what may happen to the arc over the rest of our lives here.
Right.
I agree with you, and I'm going to say more specifically, I agree with Brent Johnson that I think, given the turbulence that I think you and I think may happen over the next couple of years, I think the dollar milkshake theory, it probably is going to win out, which is that, you know, capital around the rest of the world is going to fly into the U.S. for safety, right? And part of your bond strategy is
yep.
You know, based on that. But, you know, I do think that as we get on, as we take a longer and longer timeline, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, et cetera, I think that fiat currency box is getting really shaken up right now. I mean, just with what's going on, you know, between Russia and the rest of the world right now, some really interesting things going on and highly likely to accelerate other major, national powers to advance their de-dollarization plans. Right. And that's not something that's going to happen overnight. It's probably not something that's going to be terribly noticed in the next couple of years, but who knows? But it may be noticeable in 5 years or 10 years. Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And just in general, too, it's just sort of like, look, you know, it's not a zero sum game where if other currencies are losing, another currency is winning, you know, you can have them all lose over time. Right. They'll just lose at different rates. Right. And right. I think that's that's, I think, sort of what I'm getting reminded of right now, watching what's going on, you know, here around me in Colombia. And I don't know, you know, if there's enough interest in the comment section below, maybe that is an episode, Lance, where we look forward ahead, you know, 20 years or so and say, look, you know, where is this going? What are the repercussions? What might that invite from a sort of a long-term investing strategy? And obviously, for a guy like you who has to play the game as the rules are written today, you know, what are the things you'll be looking for over time to know whether to start changing some of your plays, right? So right, anyways,
exactly.
For a longer period, but I felt it was important just to note to folks, given the very stark reminders I'm seeing here. I mean, I'm going to leave here in just a minute to go join my family for dinner. And I guarantee you, I'm going to get hit by like 10 people along the way who understandably are just trying to survive on the street, but largely because of poor monetary policy.
Well, and look, just to conclude here, I mean, look, the problems we have in the U.S. is all policy driven, and it's been decades of bad policy, and the policies that have been put in place just over the last 2 years in particular are accelerating that demise. And look, I mean, this is why we have the concerns over wealth inequality. We have people complaining about, you know, hey, give me more socialism because, you know, damn it, I'm not getting anything else. So you might as well just give me free money. You know, those claims are great. And I think it's very fascinating right now, Adam, that I'm seeing a lot of things coming out of Washington saying, well, you know, what we need to do is we need to send people money to pay for gas. The reason we have high inflation is this is the payback for all the free money.
We gave people a bunch of money, free money. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there is no free lunch. If I give people money, the tax ultimately is inflation. And that's what we're dealing with now. So giving people more money is just going to make the situation worse. So stop doing, you know, as my when I was growing up, my dad had a very simple statement. Whenever I did something, he'd say, Lance, stop doing stupid shit. And that was my message to sit there and go, okay, let's focus on logic and what's going on. And the problem with what we have in Washington is that we're doing things to get votes rather than doing things which are good policy. And good policy isn't necessarily voter friendly. But if you want a better economy, if you want a better life, if you want capitalism to work for you, you're going to have to do better policy. And better policy is painful in the short term. But the long-term benefits are well worth it.
Right, right. And sadly, and we can talk about this, I'm sure, for hours. But sadly, I feel like given the political structure we have, the political players we have, I think policy is only going to shift because it becomes too painful to continue the status quo. I don't think we have the kind of people who are going to be looking forward and saying, you know, this is going to get worse. Let's change today before it does. I think they're going to continue doing exactly what you said until literally it becomes too painful for them. Where voters literally say, if you continue this, we're voting you out of office. I think that's the only way it's going to change,
right?
Sadly. And look, I mean, in some ways, this is how politics is always run, right? I think we have kind of a particularly, I don't necessarily want to say a particularly bad crew in right now, but I think we are far enough down the road where the can's been kicked so far that they don't have opportunity to kick it much further. And so the repercussions are really beginning to build here. But I think one thing that is really lacking right now is I think we have very few people in politics who really understand economics, at least at kind of a basic fundamental level. I don't want to say you and I are the smartest guys in the world around this, but you know, we and a lot of the viewers on this channel, I think at least have sort of a decent grasp on the basics of what can make an economy sustainable, right? Mm-hmm. Where I think we have a lot of people in Congress right now, and probably in the administration too, who really don't. And to them, they're voting kind of either with their hearts or with a political agenda. Oh, people are suffering, let's give them more money. And they don't understand the role that, you know, inflation truly plays inside a system, right? So they don't realize that they're handing, you know, burning torches to somebody whose house is on fire, right? And just making it worse.
But you know, look, there's two things here. One, there are some very smart guys that are in Washington. Senator Warren Davidson, as an example, is on the Sound Money Committee. The problem is they've got no voice within the policy.
Yeah, but if nobody listens to them, it doesn't matter.
No, that's exactly right. So my point is there's some really smart guys that are in Washington that have no voice. The ones that have a voice, unfortunately, have a policy bias, shall I say, which is, You know, the problem is when you get into Washington, it's five-star dinners, it's wine and dining, it's private jets, it's all these perks that they enjoy. Of course, those all come from lobbies. So, you know, these lobbyists have a big control over policy and what happens in Washington. Good example, we just passed this $1.5 trillion, you know, omnibus spending bill that was full of pork inside that thing for all kinds of spending stuff other than just keeping the government running. But this is what happened. This is the sausage getting made behind the scenes. And this is all driven by the senators and the congressmen don't read these bills. They just vote on them because they're given the bills like 2 hours in advance. They're 2,500 pages long. They're all written by the lobbies and they have no idea what they're voting for. And they just vote. And so this is why the policy continues to get worse. And the policies that are being driven are by a small group of corporate lobbies that are creating this push that's beneficial for them. It's just not beneficial for the rest of the economy. So we've got to start going back to, you know, the way we used to do things prior to World War I. Every single bill, if you wanted to pass a spending for any item, you had to pass a bill for that item. The way we got into the bill structure now is that when World War I started, we said, look, there's too many bills. We've got to pass it one time to fight the war. We'll just put them all together and vote on them at one time. That was Pandora's box at that point. These people have no fiscal responsibility. We need to go back one bill, one item. You vote on that. And yeah, it's going to be really cumbersome. It's going to take a long time. But guess what? You'll get some fiscal responsibility back because we'll all know what they're voting on. And we'll know what they're on. We'll start knowing who to vote for. The problem now is there's so much stuff hidden behind the scenes. We have no idea. We just keep voting for Nancy Pelosi, these people, they all get voted in because we don't care. Right. We just like, whatever. I recognize that name. I'll vote for it.
Right. And Pelosi's great quote, we have to pass the bill to know what's in it. Right. Yeah,
exactly. So if you want to fix the problems, you got to start voting differently. And we got to get other people to run.
Don't disagree at all. And Lance, we could talk about this forever.
Whole another show.
Maybe we should.
We got to go.
we do got to go. We've blown through the hours. We always do. Hopefully folks have enjoyed this. The last thing I want to say in this point, because it just blows my mind, which is listen to one of these investigative podcasts a couple of years ago, and it was all trying to understand kind of how lobbies work, how lobbyists do their work. What they did is, you know, they started with the thesis of your poor politicians walking down the halls of the Capitol, and these lobbyists with big bags of money are waiting behind a column to pounce on them and, you know, try to influence what this politician's going to do. They say it's actually the exact opposite, where money plays such a vital role in politics these days, just in terms of getting elected and getting reelected, is that the vast majority of a politician's day is spent fundraising, not legislating. Mm-hmm. Right.
That's right.
And if you want to be a politician who has any influence, you have to get on an influential committee. And the more influential the committee, the more you have to demonstrate in fundraising to be able to get nominated by your party to be on that committee. So it's the politicians who are hounding the lobbyists all day long.
Yeah.
To say, I need access to your money, right?
That's right.
Now, it still ends up with these corporate lobbyists basically directing what's in the legislation. But it just shows how absolutely backwards and broken the current political system is.
It is.
All right, folks, sorry, we didn't intend to get so far off the political rails there, off the rails on the politics. If you like that, let us know. If you don't ever want us to talk about it again, let us know. All right, well, as we wrap up here, Lance, thanks so much for another great week. Folks, if you want to have a financial consultation with one of Wealthion's financial advisors, and Lance and his firm are right there at the top of the list, just stick around at the end of the video. We tell you where to go to be able to schedule one of those free, no strings attached, no commitment consultations. And if you continue to enjoy this series, hopefully you're enjoying it at least half as much as Lance and I are, then do me a favor and hit the like button and then click on the red subscribe button below. A quick ask, Wealthion is almost at 100,000 subscribers. We are just a few weeks shy of our 1 year anniversary. So I really want to try to hit that 100,000 subscriber milestone by that anniversary. So if you haven't subscribed yet, but you've been watching these videos, please take a second to do so now. Again, clicking that red subscribe button. Lance, thanks so much, buddy. Look forward to seeing you next week.
All right. See you then. Bye.
All right. Thanks for watching, everyone.